Peace, y'all. This is Big Guru, Gifted Unlimited Rhymes Universal, in the house right now on Hard Knock Radio, okay, baby?
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
I am. You listen to Richie DeMartini here with Hard Knock Radio. Oh, and you are.
I'm Yuri Pochialma with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. When I'm not throwing down on the floor of Congress, looking out and fighting for your rights, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
I'm a woman who speaks in a voice,
in a voice.
And I must be heard. At times I can be quite difficult. I'll bow to no man's word. I'm a woman who speaks in a voice,
in a voice.
And I must be heard. Difficult, I'll bow to no man's word. I'm a woman who speaks in a voice,
in a voice,
and I must be heard. At times I can be quite difficult.
Want to say what's up to everybody, Davey D hanging out with you, and we're pretty lucky. There's a big storm that's in New York. And one of our guests, well, our guest this afternoon is somebody who got stuck in San Francisco. She's widely read. She's a premier feminist, somebody who's always speaking to the issues of the day, especially as it pertains to women. She also considers herself a recovering lawyer. So she's a lawyer by day, a feminist 24/7, superheroine. Her name is Jill Filipovic. I got it right, did I not?
Very close, very close.
Well, first of all, welcome to the show, Jill. And for people who don't know, I don't know if you're an author, but I know when looking at your blogs, it's like you have like 5,000 posts on your blog. So tell everybody about the site that you are part of and what you all talk about.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I run the website Feminist, which is feminist, which is feminist with an E at the end, .us. It's one of the oldest feminist blogs in the United States. I'm also a columnist at The Guardian newspaper online, and a contributor to the anthology Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape.
There you have it. Before we get into it, you are stuck here because of the hurricane. What's that like being here in San Francisco on the night that the Giants won the World Series? You were out there with all the bonfires and everything. You took some epic pictures.
We were up in the Mission and ended up, I think, on 22nd and Mission was where the bonfires were happening. And it was strange. It started out just as a big party and everybody was very excited and it seemed very and then things started getting lit on fire, and it's, you know, I think as the night went on, people obviously were more and more intoxicated, and as how these things tend to go, it just got more aggressive.
Right. I bring that up because the pictures that you took are kind of eerie in a sense of looking at the pictures that you see in New York, where it's just like, what is going on? Cops in riot gear, you know, people just kind of all over. And so you escaped Hurricane Sandy, but you got Hurricane San Francisco Giants.
Exactly. It felt a little like Armageddon, I think, in both places.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, the issue of the day, war on women. By the time people see this on TV, on free speech, we may have the continuation of Barack Obama, or we may have Mitt Romney. But it seems to me that the war on women will still have to be fought, no matter who's the president, because most of the damage has been done with stateside legislation. So maybe you could start off by speaking to what is the lay of the land that you see going forward in terms of what needs to be fought state by state.
Sure. So we are in a pretty scary time, especially when it comes to abortion rights, birth control access, and women's issues generally. 2011 saw more abortion restrictions proposed than any other previous year since Roe v. Wade. So if you look at the Washington Post, is a great graphic where it's kind of up and down, and then 2011 hits, and it's like this giant spike. So we're seeing the right to life movement being increasingly aggressive on the state level. One issue that I don't think it's discussed nearly enough is the appointment of federal court judges. We talk a lot about the Supreme Court. That garners a lot of attention in the American media, but it's actually the federal appeals court that is making the vast majority of federal law in this country. Very few cases get to the Supreme Court.
We've talked a lot about the importance of judges and why people need to look out for the election. As a lawyer, maybe you can give some tips, because for many people, including myself, and I think I know a little something about some of the law stuff, and I have access, you can't find the judges' records. You know, you don't know how they're really, you know, ruling on things. You don't know where to look for. They have done a very good job of sanitizing their records so that when they're running for office, you know, you can't find out. And then, of course, we don't know what's going on and when they get appointed, which is usually the case with federal judges.
Right. So federal judges, the appeals courts are appointed. They have to be approved by Congress.
Right.
But, right, I mean, you can see their records, but it's just not as accessible. The legal institution in this country is actually pretty good at putting these things in certain places where they're tough to guess. They're all on legal databases that you have to pay money to access. So the average person or even the average journalist may not have access to that. You know, but these are the people that are making most of the law. So in terms of who we elect for president, that's one very important thing. Our international policy and what we do for family planning abroad is also huge. Mitt Romney has already said that one of the first things he'll do in office is reinstate what's called the global gag rule, which basically says that no provider abroad, so no healthcare provider that's, you know, providing things like HIV and AIDS treatment, well baby care to some of the poorest nations on the planet, that if those people even mention abortion as an option to pregnant women in countries where abortion is legal, or if they advocate for abortion rights in countries where it's not legal, they will get all of their US funding pulled. So all the funding for things like birth control, for things like well baby care, for things like prenatal care, you know, for women where the rate of dying in childbirth is astronomical, those people will receive zero funding if they ever use the word abortion. It's a terrifying policy. It was in place under George Bush. It resulted in the deaths of thousands and thousands of women and the injury of many, many more. It's disastrous foreign policy, and that's, Romney said he's going to do it his first week.
How has Obama ruled on that? You know, what's been his position on it since he's been in?
Mm-hmm. So it was in place under George Bush. In Obama's first week in office, he rescinded it. So under Obama, women abroad now have significantly better health care than they had under George Bush.
Now, you know, the title of the book, you know, you mentioned the word rape, and that has now become a political football that I think for many people, and I would imagine from our respective generations, you would never imagine that the term rape would be something that you're actually having a debate about. Like, there are different types of rapes and it's not that bad, and people saying somebody, well, you can talk about, because you've written pretty extensively about the litany of things that people are saying, and whether or not they get elected or reelected, there's still a sentiment that is represented, and so it seems like there's more where that came from.
Definitely. I mean, part of the Republican Party's ethos about women is that women aren't entitled to their bodies, and women are not entitled to full control over their reproductive organs. You know, so obviously that is going to carry over a little bit into the Republican view of rape and sexual assault. You know, obviously they don't believe in abortion rights, but I think when you hear them talk about things like legitimate rape or real rape, or you had Sharon Engel, I think 2 years ago in the election, talking about how rape victims who get pregnant should make a lemon situation into lemonade. You know, you have people that really just aren't really considering women to be full human beings and people that are entitled to full participation in society.
Well, even going back to the foreign policy situation, you have war-torn countries where rape is used as a weapon. And so even in those situations, you have people that are advocating that even then you can't talk about abortion in the situation of, you know, wartime rape.
Right, exactly. I mean, the UN and international groups and international human rights legal groups have recognized that rape is a tool of war and also a tool of ethnic genocide, and a way to deplete certain ethnic groups. You know, not just that soldiers use as a way to demoralize people, but also a way to just get rid of certain lines, certain cultural, religious, or racial lines. And, you know, so it's an incredibly scary tool, and it is a weapon.
How do we get to this point? You know, I started off by saying, who would have imagined that we would be here? And I'm going to put the context in the, I want to put it in the context of knowing that we came out of the 60s, where there was a lot of pushback on what they call the age of sterilization, meaning that everything was sanitized in the 1950s. It was clean picket fences, you know, two-car garage, and leave it to beaver type of family. And along with that came very defined roles of women. Women were supposed to be in the kitchen and be mothers and not work, and the father was the breadwinner. And in that time, there was a significant amount of people who could afford that. But in the 60s, there was a lot of pushback and challenge, and we saw the rise of women's rights, and that has moved on. Now we have career women, people who are the head of companies. One would think that we are, that we have advanced, but now it seems like we've gone backwards. And what's even more surprising to me is to see that there are a significant amount of women that have actually signed on to this type of thinking. What is this about?
Well, I think a lot of it is, I mean, it's a backlash to how much progress we have made. I think change is very scary for a lot of people. And change, you know, it is threatening to the dominant classes. I don't think it's a coincidence this is picked up when we have a black president in office. I think that the increase in power that previously disempowered groups across the board have had in the United States is really terrifying to the dominant white male power structure.
But we're looking at women having made advances over the past 40 years. Why now? Why over the past 3 or 4 years? It can't certainly just be because there's a black president. Were there some other things in play?
I mean, there are certainly a lot of things in play. I mean, I think you're seeing just a greater cultural conservative resurgence happening right now. There was a great book by Susan Faludi called Backlash, which she wrote, I think, toward the beginning of the 90s, maybe 1992, where you saw similar things right after Bill Clinton was elected. Mm-hmm. That you have, I think, people that feel incredibly entitled to the long-held power they've had in this country. And I think when they see that start to slip, they frankly get really pissed. And they tend to target or scapegoat whoever they see as being responsible for that. So I think you see people of color targeted, I think you see immigrants targeted, you see gay people targeted, and you see women targeted.
Is it a generational thing?
I hope so, but I'm not sure. I think sexism and misogyny is pretty deeply rooted in our culture and in our country.
Let's just build on that for a second. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with a columnist, writer, author, lawyer, feminist extraordinaire, Jill Filipovich, and she is our guest this afternoon. I think the issue of misogyny has been around for a long time, and it gets defined in many different ways. Some people might see misogyny, well, there are various degrees of misogyny, I should say. You know, it could be verbal abuse, it could be workplace harassment, it could be some physical assaults. There's all these different things. For the sake of the conversation, I think that's something that people have been trying to deal with for a very long time. But this whole thing around the brutality of rape and this really assault, this outright assault on women to the point that you go through something brutal and you're gonna have to make lemons out of lemonade type of attitude, that seems to be coming from a different strand. I don't think it's a natural outgrowth of misogyny. It seems like there's something else going on. That's just how I see it, but maybe you see this differently.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think these views have existed for a long time. I mean, I've been writing about and reading about and covering the pro-life movement in the U.S. for, you know, years now.
Okay.
And, you know, I think even 10 years ago, you were seeing those kind of comments crop up from pro-life leaders on pro-life websites and at their conferences. But it was very much marginalized.
Right.
You know, there's no pro-life group in the U.S. that favors abortion in the case of rape or incest. And there's no pro-life group in the U.S. that supports birth control access,
right,
which is such a basic thing that almost all Americans are in favor of. Those views have always existed. They've just sort of flown below the radar because they're not popular. I think what we're seeing happening now...
But they're not popular amongst the majority population.
Right.
And we've seen poll after poll to show that. So were they deliberately given access, given a platform, or did they come up with a new selling point that people brought into?
Well, I think you, in the last elections 2 years ago, in the midterms, we had this Tea Party resurgence. And I think you got a lot of people into positions of power that were not career politicians, that were not as sanitized as the traditional Republicans. And, you know, they just didn't know how to play the game as well. And that we'll just read from these pro-life group talking points because they know that's, you know, where a lot of their money and support is coming from. And then, you know, the American people are then shocked when this stuff gets widely disseminated.
As we've seen the rise of this sort of attitude, we've seen women's rights under the term feminism take some deep hits. As a feminist, what do you think has been done right or wrong in the movement? Let's start. What do you think has been the shortcomings of the movement that we see in a rise of this? Or is that even a fair question?
Of the feminist movement?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there, like any social justice movement, I think there are a lot of shortcomings. I think that the feminist movement could certainly be much more inclusive and understanding that women are 50% of the population. We don't all have identical interests.
Right.
And we have interests that go well beyond reproductive rights. You know, what a low-income immigrant woman in Arizona needs is very different than what me, an almost 30-year-old white woman in New York, needs.
Right.
Our experiences as women are overlapping in some points, but are different. And the feminist movement, given that, you know, it's run by people with relatively high levels of privilege,
right,
does tend to focus on the needs of urban, white, middle-class, upper-middle-class women.
Well, even with that, then, one might say, well, that means that there's a body of women that have a certain amount of access. So, for example, if you go to a school, you know, you don't necessarily see women's rights as part of the curriculum. So the question would be that over the 30 or 40 years, why don't we see that really just ingrained from grade school on up? And I'm contrasting that with the attempts that are being made by the far right to make sure that their viewpoints are part of textbooks and are being taught from grade one. They're rewriting textbooks as we speak, mm-hmm, and making sure that, you know, that their view of the world is what is taught to the young kids. So that's what I mean when I'm asking, like, what do you think? Was there a distraction? Did people go off in a different direction, or was there, did people not think in those terms to really make sure that basic tenets of what we would consider women's rights are institutionalized?
Right. I mean, I think one of the big victories of the feminist movement has been to not so much institutionalize the tenets of our beliefs, but create a cultural groundwork for them. I mean, you wouldn't meet very many Americans today who would say, I don't think women deserve equal rights, or I don't think women deserve the vote, or whatever. I mean, what you will hear is people arguing about things that I think conservatives have done a very good job is framing as not about gender equality. So things like abortion rights, things like equal pay, you know, things like access to this, you know, the same healthcare, that they frame as almost special rights for women, as if we're some, you know, small interest group and not half the population.
Well, that framing has been effective in terms of the conversation. For example, when President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Act, I thought that would just be a slam dunk. And I was really surprised when I heard people, well-meaning people, say, well, you know, that's not really true. Women do get the same pay and they don't all deserve that. And it was just like, it seemed like for day one, they had a talking point, they had a way in which to frame it, and that was already being pushed. My initial question to you is, what will be the steps that you all, as feminists who I think have a majority viewpoint, what do you think you all will start to do in terms of setting up strategy and moving forward so that this type of era is something that is in a distant past and is something that doesn't gain any more footing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk and debate about, you know, sort of the best way to do this. I mean, it's not like the feminist movement is just one cohesive thing either, right? Like, there's a lot of groups and interest areas and individuals that are all right. That are all part of this. I personally would like to see us being a little bit more proactive. I think because the conservative movement in the U.S. is so powerful, we're often on the defensive, and right. We're fighting against anti-abortion legislation. We're fighting against all of these encroachments on our rights. And I would like to see us fighting for things like mandated federal parental leave, you know, which we are one of the only developed countries that doesn't have maternity leave as federal policy, which is right. Scary. I would like to see us fighting for things like birth control access to the morning after pill, even abortion access, and actually putting laws on the books, at least in the more liberal states, that would enshrine these things into law.
Well, why can't that happen? You're a lawyer, and you know other lawyers. And I'm not saying it to be funny, but
yeah.
I'm just
no,
like,
I,
I'm just looking and saying, let's take advantage. What would be the process that you, Jill Filipovich, would have to go through to start, you know, taking this vision and saying, for example, parental leave, make that a federal thing? What would be the steps that you could just start the ball rolling, like after we do this interview?
Right. Well, I guess I would probably have to speak with my congressperson or senator. But yeah, I mean, I think what's hard is it's a resources issue, right? And it's a triage. And when you're talking about all of these, this inundating number of anti-woman legislation that's coming down the pipeline, and you're spending so much effort trying to push it back and push it back and push it back, mm-hmm. it's really hard then to turn around the other way and start to make things happen the way you want it to go.
Right.
I do wish we would all dedicate more resources to that. But
is it really a resource thing, or can, and I'm asking this in a sense, you know, you mentioned that you would talk to your congressperson. One question would be, have the Congress people that many feminists have championed, have they been doing the job? Have they been responsive? Or do you do like the Tea Party in the far right, the evangelicals have done, and said, you know what, I'm just gonna run for office? I mean, it was a period of time for a number of years, and definitely at the start of Barack Obama's presidency, that there were blue dog Democrats. And some of them held maybe not as Neanderthalic type of views, but they weren't necessarily, you know, swinging a baseball bat on your behalf. Do people like yourselves start to groom folks, run them for office, and say, you will champion these causes for us because this is what's needed?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see that happen. I mean, especially in places where there are, you know, Democratic pockets where we're electing very conservative Democratic senators.
Right.
You know, a lot of the people that were opposing the health care bill because of the birth control issue were Democrats.
Right, blue dog Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the problem that you run into there, and I understand party-wide why it's an issue, is that can those people then get elected if they're more liberal Democrats in the places that they're running? So it's a tough question. I mean, if you run a more liberal person in certain areas of, you know, rural Pennsylvania, are you actually going to get a Democratic seat there, or is a Republican just going to win?
The majority. So that's what I'm trying to figure
right.
out. If you ask most women, should you have a right to choose your birth control, you would get 80-90%. Mm-hmm. Should a woman have a right to choose in terms of an abortion, you get high numbers. So with those high numbers, how come it doesn't necessarily translate into a vibrant electoral representatives?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the numbers for abortion aren't that high.
Really?
Yeah, among women, I believe it is still, it's a pro-choice majority.
Right.
And most people do, in the United States, do believe that there should be, you know, abortion rights with some restrictions.
Right.
But people do want more restrictions than, honestly, what I would want, or
wow.
that a lot of liberal Democrats would want.
Okay.
And abortion and gay marriage still, unfortunately, are such wedge issues in electoral groups that, you know, are very important and where the blue dogs tend to get elected.
Right.
That those two social issues just kill the party, which is very frustrating because they're basic human rights issues.
I can imagine. What we're going to do is we're going to take a break. We've been talking with Jill Falufovich. You can read her material. She has like, what is it, like 4,715 posts, you know, on feminist.com. She's also in The Guardian in the UK. You can see her on Altnet. And she pops up on TV a lot, including this show on Free Speech. So it's good to have you here. When we come back, I want to talk to you about how is this war on women, where you have people who are vehemently opposed to women's rights, birth control, abortion, access, all this stuff, why we see it being men, you know, being the main people speaking. So when we come back, let's talk about that. We'll be right back.
Deep inside, I can feel the anger bubble. You can see it in my face, baby. I am not subtle. Pushing him away because it ain't the time to cuddle. Wearing the heart on the sleeve, see, it's internal trouble. Sipping on the raspberry Stoli and I'm seeing double. Know about the killings, ignorance will not clear the rubble. Calling on the team, everybody get up in the huddle. You can count on this leader, knowing she will not fumble. I will speak calm and clear, I will not mumble. Time for peaceful rumble, depression made me crumble. Some need an assess, so we grab it by the buns. Are we marching on no stumble? Always remain humble. Never need to bow, yo, we always on the prowl. Indigo children, will you stand up now? Fight the power, take control, and take this vow. All my strong women, stand up now. Stand up now. Stand up. Takeover. I mean peaceful, see that Gemini make over, but it ain't the twins blowing up the Range Rover. I will stay sober, wishing on a clover, engaging the youth like I'm Fraggle Rock and Rover. Marge and Homer, I'm that socialite loner, writing in the corner on my pocket PC as I hum, let it all out through the thumb. Texting on the pad, I ain't having no fun. I wanna run and I feel like the end has come. But before you agree, love, tell me why we all can't drum pound our way to freedom. You know at one point I believed them that all was well. Then I felt the earth swell and I came back from hell. You can call me hell, sitting in my own cell, calling on my ladies and I'm ringing bells, ringing bells. This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it. This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it.
This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it.
They don't care how they make a dollar, use a child killer parent, do you hear me holla? Before we blow up more innocent people, they be flocking to the church, bowing to the steeple. But be the one that's evil, thinking they treating everyone equal. It's a sequel, using the name of God to fight, forgetting their values, no wrong from right. Money in that Glock sight, oil steel, their pockets tight, not giving a puff about the poor's plight or who they indict. A third in jail each and every night. Prison industry, modern day slavery, corporations on lock and key. Big brother, he be watching me. Only privilege is to do, see. If you're lucky and you're white male, then you get to be free. This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it. This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it.
This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it. At an early age I felt the rage surging through my veins, the pains of living with thoughts of splattered brains. You either live in hood or you're bound by chains, the white men who wish the laws had never changed. I did a couple years in a cubicle, sitting, thinking, biting on my cubicle. Inexpensive living got us trapped up in a building, a bunch of angry people cramped up, you know the feeling. Got me kneeling, Hail Mary, each day I grow weary. Friends died I love dearly, I talk, can't still fear me. Set trip or deceive me, you'll suffer, believe.
you befriended me. But I'm an outcast with a dirty past, with a heart of harder cast, blessed and fast, using my door cloud as a man praying.
This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it. This is revolutionary music, and you should like it and you should choose it. A lot of powers that be will misuse it, but don't lose it, it's your voice, use it.
No, we are not a commodity, we are not property, we are women, and we are strong. So hold your head up and be the queen that you are. And don't ever, ever let anyone else tell you otherwise.
Davey D back with you, our guest from Feminist.com, Jill Filipovich. She is a well-known author, a strong advocate for women's rights, a feminist. You wear that title proudly.
Wear it well.
Wear it well. Before we went to break, I was asking about the dominating role that men have played in this fight in terms of setting the rules, demanding that women's rights be pulled back. We know the whole scenario with which came to a halt this year with a woman named Sandra Fluke. Here we are having hearings, you know, before the Senate and on birth control and women's reproductive rights, and there's no women on the panel. And of course, she made her way down there to talk, and next thing you know, she was called a slut and a hoe and all kind of names like this. But I would have thought that there would just be more outcry that, you know, we're the women. You know, if I was talking about, say, Jewish policy, and we didn't have anybody who's Jewish on there, I'm sure they'd be like, well, what the hell? If we were talking about black rights, and it's all white folks, somebody would be like, what the hell? So why didn't we see the type of outrage on that? And what is it with so many men being in the forefront of pushing back on women's issues?
Yeah, you do see this a lot, these images of an entire table full of white men legislating women's rights. You saw the iconic photo when George Bush signed the Partial Birth Abortion Act, which outlawed a certain form of abortion, and it's literally a group of like 15 smiling men all signing this thing and not a single woman. And the same thing with these birth control hearings. You know, I think you did see some outrage from female Congress people. There were some great speeches on the House floor demanding that women's voices be heard. That's why Sandra Fluke ended up getting able to testify. But yeah, you know, in the media, there definitely was not enough coverage or anger about that. And there were not enough male congressmen up there raising hell about this. And the right really managed to position that as a religious freedom issue, even though we're talking about birth control, which is clearly a women's issue.
This is not the first time this has happened, though. And so, again, I come back to the question, and this is one that I'm not trying to pick on the feminist movement or anything like that, but I think when we have so many various groups that are under assault, immigrant groups are under assault, you know, students are under assault, women are under assault, black folks are under assault. Are we bridging and, you know, building bridges so that when we see these things, that they're the coalition of people that immediately react because they realize that the assaults are coming from the same source, or are we just in our own silos?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there should be a lot more bridge building, and not, you know, because in part because of what you say, that the assaults are all coming from the same place, but also because our interests are intertwined and wrapped up in each other, right? Like, people of color are not over here and women are over here. You know, women are people of color also.
Right.
And, you know, all of our interests really overlap. And I think I said this earlier, but really I think what's at the heart of this anger and a lot of this backlash against, you know, what we're calling minority groups, but if you put us all together, we're, you know, quite a vast majority in this country. It's a challenge to the dominant power structure.
Right.
And a country where for hundreds of years we've had the same very small, very elite group of people who have been in control of everything.
Right.
And that has shifted incredibly rapidly. Not rapidly enough for my personal taste, but
right.
You know, rapidly enough where I think for a lot of people it's very undermining and very threatening and very scary. And so you're seeing the scapegoating and, you know, targeting of all of the groups that this powerful coalition sees as a threat.
But there's also been some victories too. Can we talk about
major
those?
Victories.
Let's talk about some of them, starting with Mississippi. That looked like an insurmountable situation. H.R. 56, which was going to be a parenthood bill, very conservative state, very Bible Beltish type of state, but it didn't happen. But there's more of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, the personhood bills have been proposed in several states.
For people who don't know, let's explain personhood bills.
Sure. So the personhood bills are bills that are being proposed by very far-right Republicans. Paul Ryan actually proposed one in Washington, D.C., which would make a fertilized egg a person under U.S. law. So the second sperm meets egg, that is a person.
So that would outlaw certain types of birth control.
It would outlaw certain types of birth control, obviously all abortions, and a lot of in vitro fertilization and fertility processes that fertilize an egg outside of the woman's body and then implant it. It also brings up a series of logistical issues, which I don't think anybody has really considered.
If
that's a person, at what point do you get a social security number? More than half of fertilized eggs don't implant naturally. They just flush out of the woman's body. This is how nature works. So do we now have a death rate that is astronomical?
One might theoretically charge you with murder, possibly.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing, right? So if my egg is fertilized and I don't know it's fertilized and I am, go out drinking one night, or I jump on a trampoline, or I drive my car recklessly and get in a car accident, or I go skiing, or I do any number of things that, who knows, in some universe may dislodge a fertilized egg from my uterus. Was I negligent? Should I go to jail for that? Have I just killed a baby? Which is their argument, which is insane, obviously.
Right.
But so these are very scary laws.
But this is something that people not only pushing stateside, but want to make a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, exactly. And it would, like you said, outlaw, or they're hoping it would outlaw a lot of forms of birth control. And in actuality, birth control doesn't really interfere with fertilized eggs, but we're not talking about people that are very wedded to the scientific facts of things,
right,
you know?
Right.
So,
well, if we're moving in this direction, what's scary to me is that it's already reached a point where you now have people proposing legislation. You know, that this is a discussion that, it seems like every 5 minutes they're trying to put this on hold. What's the strategy for pushback? We were talking about some of the success stories, around the personhood bill. So maybe we can continue there.
Yeah, I mean, so the strategy in for all of these bills, actually, there's one in Colorado a couple years ago, there's one in D.C., there have been a series in various southern states, it has been to inform voters of what this actually does. Mm-hmm. I think this idea of defining personhood is very appealing to people, and so they just see, life starts at conception, and voters think, that's what I think, so, check the box.
Right.
And I think, literally going door to door and explaining to people, well, if this law passes, here's what this is actually going to mean for you.
Right.
It means that you don't get the birth control that, you are using. It means that fertilization treatments are going to be curbed. It means that we're going to have all of these bureaucratic issues,
right,
in deciding how we actually are going to carry out this law.
One of the ironies to this is that, okay, they don't want to give you birth control. They don't want to allow abortions. But if you are unwed and have a child, then you're considered irresponsible. If you're poor and have a child, you're somehow leeching off the system, and we've seen that sort of demonization go on. And we now have more than kids than we care to count who are unwanted, born, into these situations where it's dire straits, the whole nine. So, and that same group of people doesn't seem to be stepping up to want to make sure that those kids, these innocent lives that they're so concerned about, have a good foothold, irregardless of the status of the mom.
Right. I mean, there's sort of a regular saying in pro-choice circles that pro-lifers are pro-life up until the moment of birth.
Okay.
And every year, children's rights organizations, they do surveys of who are the best legislators for children in the country and who are the worst. And every year, all of the worst legislators for children's rights in the United States are pro-life legislators.
Right.
So there is this disconnect. you know, it's also, frankly, not brain surgery to figure out what decreases the abortion rate. We can look at countries that have the lowest abortion rates in the world, and what you see is they have free and accessible birth control. They almost all of that, all for, on all of them, abortion is legal, and almost all of them, abortion is free. And they have good sex education, and they also have a secure welfare net. And they have cultures that don't demonize sex the way that we do.
I was going to ask, it seems like the fear of sex. Is this what, and you've written about this, you've written about this whole puritanical attitude, this whole situation of saving yourself for marriage, all these different types of things that people say on paper, but they actually don't practice in real life. I mean, my experience over the years of going to some of these conventions, especially at the GOP, they're actually a pretty loose and wild bunch. You know, a few drinks and all that talk goes out the window, you know? So what is it about this whole puritanical attitude? Is there a fear of sex?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's partially a fear of sex. And I think it's also, we have a very consumptive and capitalist view of sex, where it's Jessica Valenti described it in one of her books as abstinence-only education during the day and girls gone wild commercials at night. So Right. We use sex and women's bodies and, you know, sexualized, increasingly younger sexualized girls to sell everything, you know, and to titillate and to sort of feed the machine. But when it comes to actual sex and pleasurable sex and, you know, especially women having sex that feels good and is fulfilling, we're terrified of that. And we push back on it extremely hard. And, you know, we shame women who are in any way vocal or public about having sex and enjoying it in a way that's for their own well-being and not for selling something to someone else.
Is connected to this fear, there seems to be an outright hatred of women. And what I mean by that, I remember a few years ago, there was a tour that was put on by Rap Sessions, and they were asking, do people hate, you know, do their fear of women, and is there a hatred of women? Because in many of the songs that were coming out, there just seemed to be like, wow, did you really say that? But it wasn't just limited to that. And even though that tour went around and these discussions were held in town halls and people were grappled with that, we've seen a rise, at least what is publicly reported and invisible, in terms of assaults on women. And I'm not just talking about the Chris Brown, Rihanna situations. I'm talking about police officers in New York where you're at. We've seen police officer rape and get off. And the entire department backed that up and questioned the woman. We've seen another cop hold a woman as a sex slave. We've seen just recently a type of similar situation. And we can go on and on. We can go all around the country and see acts of violence, assaults, not talking about rapes, just, you know, I'm gonna punch her out, knock her out. And these things get celebrated, they're highlighted, and people are very rarely penalized in a way that I would think would suggest that would send a message out that says this is unacceptable at all costs. What is this about? Is this part of this anger, you know, that I think, or may, it seems like there are a number of men that have a real anger towards women?
Yeah, I think that's right. You do see, I think all of these things are interconnected. I think violence against women is...
And one other point, mm-hmm. The amount of rapes that are going on in the military.
Right.
Which nobody wants to talk about, but this is a very high incident. You know, 1 out of 3 women in the military. This is crazy.
Right. You know, and rapes of military women and, you know, rapes of women who live in countries that are invaded by the U.S. military. Yeah, I think that a cultural view that doesn't see women as fully equal and doesn't see women as fully entitled to their own physical safety and their own bodies permeates almost every aspect of our culture. We were talking earlier about how it permeates our political culture. And when you see violence against women, when you see rape, you know, when you see police officers abusing their power to commit assault and knowing often that they're going to get away with it, it all goes back to that same fundamental perspective that, you know, women just don't have the right to even be safe in their own homes, in their own skin, which is why, you know, we all need to be, I think, pretty vigilant, not only about obviously opposing violence against women and sexual assault. Everybody's going to say that they oppose those things. But, you know, for men actually interfering and interceding, you know, if you see the guy at the bar who's clearly trying to go home with a girl who's, you know, too drunk to know what she's doing, stepping in, you know, culturally and socially shaming men that abuse women instead of protecting them. You know, and then on a political level, advocating for the kind of laws and rights that will send a direct message that, you know, women are just as entitled to our bodies as men are.
As we close out, first, what are a couple of columns that you would direct people to of your writings that really kind of underscore some things that you want to leave our audience with? Like, I need you to read this, I need you to read that, and I need you to read this, and this will really inform you and get you in a mindset that will be productive.
I think the Yes Means Yes anthology, which you can buy at hopefully your local bookstore or online, is probably the project that I've been most proud of that I've worked on. It came out, I believe, in 2008 or 2009. Okay. It's a couple of years old, but it's a series of essays on sexual assault and rape culture from some of the best writers on the internet.
Some of the writers that are in there?
LaToya Peterson from Racialicious. It's edited by Jessica Valenti and Jacqueline Friedman.
Okay.
A whole variety of great women writers. Samita Mukhopadhyay from Feministing has a great piece in it. There's a foreword by Margaret Cho, which is very as funny as you can make a foreword for a sexual assault book. I wrote a column for The Guardian a couple weeks ago, basically promoting sex before marriage that I had a good time writing that I'd recommend. And then Feminist.
And you break down the history of that in that article about the whole thing, about this whole chastity thing and what that's all about at the end of the day. I just sum it up as like control the woman's body.
Exactly.
That's what it's really about. So that one you can get in The Guardian. What's the other one?
And then Feminist, which is feminist.us, we have a staff of writers and we also regularly bring on a series of guest writers who are incredibly talented and very generously give their time and their words to us.
Can men be feminists? And I'm asking that not to be funny, but it seems like that's the new hustle. Like, I'm a feminist type of guy. And, you know, and out here in the Bay Area, there were people that were doing that, and they started to call them activists because they would say the right stuff, but their whole end game, that was like their calling card. You know, so what does it really mean when you are, as a male, a strong ally towards women's rights? You know, and this is not like the new pickup line, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, if you're a man who considers himself a feminist or in favor of women's rights, which I would hope most men are, just walk the walk, you know, and do things, frankly, that maybe women can't do. I mean, if I see another woman being harassed or attacked at a bar by a man, you know, or out on the street, I'm maybe not going to be the best person to intercede there. You know, if you see men street harassing women, if you see men hollering at women, like I said earlier, going after like the one drunk girl at the bar, I mean, actually step in. So do the work that male allies can do that
or even just
is a little
talk
harder
to,
for women.
Just talk to other men before it even gets to that point.
Right. You know, interfere if, you know, somebody's telling a sexist joke or making like a horrible comment that you know they would never make if a woman was around. You know, recognize that that actually does have a role in misogynist culture.
Recognize male privilege is what, okay.
And fight back.
Fight back. And then your magic wand, what are three things that you would see unfold as we move forward, you know, beyond this election? What are things that you would, what are marching orders that you would give to folks?
Oh, if I got to like wave a wand and just,
I
get three wishes?
Yeah, you get your thing. This is what you want people to do. Plant that seed.
Well,
you're the president, you're in charge.
Okay. I mean, I would love to see like a holistic bill of women's rights. So things like maternity leave and paternity leave, baby care, universal health care, the whole package for women and men and children to have healthy families.
So women's bill of rights.
That would be my number one.
Okay.
I think my number two would be if I could just shift the culture of masculinity in the United States. I would love to see more men being fully involved fathers and partners to their children and to their partners. And I would love to see toxic masculine culture shift, where that what it meant to be a man was about you know, how reliable you were, and that you were also an emotional person and a good person instead of just a strong person or a breadwinner. You know, that men could be defined by something other than their ability to provide money. I would love to see that shift so that we can actually appreciate the much more, you know, the wider and more holistic set of characteristics that that men have. That would be my number two, better masculinity.
Okay. And your last one?
And I guess my number three would be if I could just like explode traditional gender roles, I would love to do that. You know, so that it wouldn't be such a big deal if, you know, you're a dude and you want to wear a dress out. You know, if you're a woman and you want to be, you know, an electrician. I mean, obviously there are female electricians, there are men who wear dresses. You know, but these things are still so entrenched.
I recently went to the Nassau, you know, one of the space science museums here, and I was really surprised because it was for children and all the experts were men. And I was like really surprised, like, wow, didn't Sally Ride just pass? I mean, there was none of that there. And it just didn't occur to them, like, you know, find somebody and put them there and let them answer the science question. Let them also be a part of that conversation. So it seems like in 2012, we still have a long way to go. But I think it's, you know, taking away, as you said, the rigidness of gender roles. So we appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Jill
Filipovich. Watch out for her. Look out for her. She's everywhere. Yeah, she'll be stuck in a hurricane near you soon. And I want to thank you for, you know, taking time out.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
And feminism isn't just for women. Is justice just for women? Is equality just for women? Is freedom just for women? I don't think so. We have to be in this together to be the change we want to see. We need alliances. We need friendship. We need solidarity. Walk with me.
I had a dream about a dream. I was wide awake, right around high noon, just past midnight. I had a dream about a dream. I was wide awake, right around high noon, just past midnight. I flew through the navy blue. There was a silent blindness that I could see and hear. Within the thickening fog, my vision was clear. One was peace,
free of fear.
I had a dream about a dream. Stood there alone. We were all connected.